Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, presented by Trainer Road, where you can get answers to your coaching questions. I am Coach Jonathan Lee, and here joining me as normal is Coach Chad Timmerman. How you doing, Chad?
Doing well, Jonathan.
And also Nate Pearson, CEO of Trainer Road. How you doing, Nate?
Doing good.
Good stuff. You can submit your questions to us, and we can provide answers to these questions during this podcast. The way you get us those questions is by just getting in touch with us at support@trainerroad.com. You can find this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. Just search for Trainer Road, cycling, or any of those keywords, and it should pop up. And you can leave us a review on iTunes as well. Leave us a 5-star review if you feel so inclined and feel that we deserve it, of course. And leave any feedback you have on there. We love reading all that feedback. So we'll get things started with Mike's questions, and he has a number of questions today. So here we go. In 2014, I followed the 40 kilometer time trial training plan. So that's one of our training plans we have. I found that on the higher intensity trainer road rides and in my races, my calves would get crampy on the bike and would give me problems in the first 5 to 10 minutes of the run. Sometimes I would end up with muscle injuries that would take a week or so to resolve post-race. I don't think it's a strength issue because I do stay on top of my strength training, including straight and bent knee heel raises. I didn't find it to be as much of an issue this season, but then the Olympic distance and long course distance trainer road plans don't have the same degree of intensity that the 40-kilometer time trial plan does. So those are the plans that he was doing this year. However, now that the season is over and I've tried a few higher intensity rides again, the problem is creeping back. What's going on and how can I prevent this?
Mike, a couple things spring to mind here. The first is bike fit. If your saddle is a little too high and you're reaching a little too much with your lower legs, that's a lot of extra stress on your calf muscles. Secondly, it could be tied to the intensity of the workout. And you see, you stay on top of your strength training and that's all good and fine, but it doesn't necessarily carry to the sort of effort you're putting out on the bike. There are very different contractions, very different rates of recruitment and all those fancy terms. So it could just be a matter of pushing a little too hard.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that in general, the common thing with triathletes is your seat's too high. So definitely your seat could be too high. Another thing, this is kind of wacky advice, so probably not follow this one, but you could try like a running shoe, like a Newton, not during races, but during training. If anyone's ever ran a Newton's, like run just like a mile the first day and build up from there. But it has like a little platform underneath the ball of your foot, and it totally stresses your calves more. My thinking about this is that you could, in training, you could exercise your calves a whole bunch more. And then during race day, you can switch back to a whatever your regular running shoe is, and kind of, you'd kind of overtrain it before you race. And if you're using Newtons right now and you're getting this symptom, stop using Newtons, because they will totally... Like the first time I ran Newtons, I ran 5 miles, and the next day, like, I couldn't stand up straight. Yeah, no, because they were so tense and tight, I couldn't stand up straight. It was crazy.
Yeah, that actually makes me realize that this could also be a question of shoe fit. I've bounced from shoe to shoe to shoe, and typically what makes me gravitate to a new shoe, outside of, you know, maybe a team sponsorship or something, is cramping feet. So I tried high arch support for a while. That seemed to help, but I think it was maybe too much of a high arch support. Just played around with it. We'll pull the shoes out of different types of shoes, stick different soles from other shoes into those shoes. And eventually I found a combination that kept my feet from cramping.
Yeah. My favorite shoe for training and racing are the Lunar Racers. And there's been a whole bunch of different ones, but I really like a really light, minimal shoe. In general, I know that has nothing to do with this question, but someone might be interested in it a little bit.
Well, and tying into this, I think this could potentially, and this is hard for us to speak on, we're not physios or anything like that, but tying into this, I would say that it'd be a good idea to look into getting in contact with the physio to see if you have any type of imbalance that's also just contributing to this. Like we've talked about equipment and making sure you're flexible and strong and making sure that everything is aligned and making sure that you don't have an imbalance, you know, up in your hamstrings that's causing tension through your calf or anything else like that.
I have another idea too. You could push the cleats back farther on your foot, because if they're really kind of close to the toe, that will emphasize your calf. So if you can kind of move it back more midfoot, And you'll probably have to also lower your seat a tiny bit when you do that because of the extension will be different. But that will also put less strain on your calf while you're riding. And that's probably, actually, I think that's pretty good advice. That might be a good place to start is if you're, like, look at your cleat. If it's way in front, try pushing it back.
Yeah, that's a great point. Great point. Good catch, Nate. Now, the second question that Mark has, Mike asks, given my limited budget for aero gear, is there merit in shaving my arms and legs for races? And there definitely is. It's long been, I guess, a point of confusion, but Specialized has done an awesome job of quantifying these things on their YouTube channel, and you can check it out. So we looked that up for shaved arms, and this guy, and they have something they call the Chewbacca scale, so that's how hairy you are. So if you're a 10 out of 10, you're probably somebody that... you probably go through a lot of razors, it's fair to say. But if you are a 1 out of 10, you're probably the type of person that actually doesn't even consider shaving. So they had a guy that was in middle ground, and he saved 19 seconds over 40 kilometers with shaved arms. So that's pretty significant right there. And then with legs, and just to give you an idea with legs, they had gains from 50 seconds all the way up to, I believe it was a minute and 20 or a minute and 30 seconds. It averaged out over, after doing, I think, 5 to 10 people, somewhere around there, it averaged out to a minute and 10 in savings over 40 kilometers. It's huge.
I used to never shave my legs, and then I read this a while ago, and I take a razor now to races, and I, like, shave any part of skin that is, besides my head, that's exposed. You know, another thing, too, is they tested beards, and they didn't find a difference, which was so weird.
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, you know, and I guess maybe... granted, they didn't test like a Grizzly Adams beard or anything else like that, right? The guy they tested definitely had facial hair, but it was close to the face. It wasn't anything.
Yeah, but the beard's in front of the body when you're down in that aero position, so I can see why that wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It's going to hit your body anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah. That gives you the info you need there. Shave.
It's so crazy. A minute 10, that's like insane.
It's massive.
And then if you do legs or arms, you get another almost 20 seconds out of that.
I've lost races by a minute 10, and I have pretty hairy legs, and just makes me mad. All that training, I just could have shaved.
Yeah, think back to your last time trial or bike split or anything else like that, and you'll probably see where you could get gains there.
Yeah, you don't need to be fast. You just need to be smooth.
Yeah, and you know, also on top of these, or I guess just piggybacking on top of this, the same thing, I mean, if you're going to be optimizing that optimizing for hair growth, optimize your kit too. Don't be the type of person that like spends a huge amount of time or money on one aspect of your aerodynamic performance and then just neglects another. You know, having a flappy number on your skin suit is a good example of that. So make sure it's all refined. That's just one piece to it. Next question. I followed the 40 kilometer TT training plan back in 2014 and moved my FTP from 220 to 230. This seemed like a lot of hard work for a marginal gain. And Mike's question is that normal?
That's in my experience, Mike, that's kind of low for an entire specialty training plan to only increase it. What is that, about 3 or 4%? That's on the low side of things. That doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't effective, though. You may have actually pushed right up against your potential, whether that's your long-term potential or just your potential for that season. I'm not sure what training led into that 40K specialty program, but typically we see bigger gains than that. But if you're very fit, that's actually a pretty substantial gain. So it's relative to the sort of fitness you brought into it.
And also, if you lost weight during that time, that could be a really big gain because it's all about power to weight ratio. So if you went from 220 to 230 and you lost some pounds, you have to take that into account. Like let's say you went from 300 to 300, but you lost 25 pounds. Like that would be an outstanding gain over that winter. And it's really hard to do lose weight and gain power at the same time. Usually they're... I mean, you can do a little bit, but you're not going to have a huge weight loss and a huge power gain unless you're a very beginner and you have a whole bunch of extra body fat.
And this is high-intensity training, too. So there's a lot of factors that contribute to the effectiveness of relatively high intensity, right? The 40-kilometer time trial is really building that threshold power. So there are a lot of factors that go into that because that's really taxing stuff. It's difficult. So recovery and making sure that you're taking care of your P's and Q's on that end can really affect, you know, the outcomes as well. So
yeah, and you might also find out that you're training the wrong way. Maybe this training plan and its composition doesn't suit what you need. Maybe you need more muscular endurance, less power, VO2 max, maybe vice versa. So you can also tweak maybe the weeks within the plans, or just try mixing things up a bit and maybe favor the type of workout that seems to, for whatever reason, yield better gains. You don't have to stick rigidly to these plans if you know for a fact that they're not working.
And then the final, or you have, yeah, what, two more questions. The second to last one. Lastly, this year, I used the Olympic distance triathlon specialty phase and long course tri specialty phase training plans. So once again, more of our training plans. I squeezed a couple of sprint distance races between my Olympic and half iron event. I found that my race speed was at PR pace for me. Could it be that I respond better to slightly less intense training? I also shed about 7 pounds of body weight, so this is tying into what we were talking about. Could that result in significant speed gain? So, Chad, go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of what I just said. So you may have found something that actually works a little bit better for you. And then, of course, the weight loss doesn't hurt at all.
Yeah, especially with, with running. If you're on the same course, your bike speed is flat, your weight's not going to matter too much. But 7 pounds of running weight, oh my gosh, huge. That's awesome. You're going to, like, that's... They like a rule of thumb, and this is just a rule of thumb, but about for every pound you lose, about 2 seconds per minute mile faster. So that could be about a 14 second per mile speed improvement, which, you know, over so that could be about 45 seconds over a 5K run, which would be awesome. And then your bike is probably going to be a little bit faster too. Not insanely faster because we're on TT bikes and it's usually point to point finish a loop finish rather than a point to point. But yeah, the body weight, that's awesome.
Well, and any time the road turns upward, even at a small degree, but of course it gets more exaggerated as the road turns steeper, that weight comes into play as well. So if it's a rolling course or anything else. So.
But you get it, you get most of it back on the downhill. You do have to fight wind on the downhill, so you lose a little bit, but it's they've done like physics stuff with this is that for like a TT where you're riding by yourself and you can't draft, body weight, like aerodynamics is more important than just body weight in general. But if you're in a road race, it's totally different with like staying with the pack and making a breakaway. And, you know, it's different than doing a time trial.
It's totally true. I absolutely can't stand heavy people on downhills. I need a technical downhill to get any advantage because that's where I'm really good. But if it's not, I have to work to stay in their draft because I don't weigh enough. So, and the final question from Mike, do you think power meters will ever come down in price to where speed and cadence sensors are? Nate?
No. There'll have to be a different technology. So right now, the strain gauges are very inexpensive, but the price is because of doing... It's the assembly. So there's a manual process with that. I think Ashton Power Meters, I talked to those guys. They're, I think, from MIT. I saw them at Eurobike or Interbike 2 years ago. They had a different way of measuring it without using strain gauges. A couple people now I've seen are starting to do that. But, in general, the actual Ant Bluetooth chip is very inexpensive. So that's, to manufacture or to buy that, it's in the single digit for dollars. And then, it could, but there'd have to be a significant improvement in some type of technology for it to really do that. You know, and too, though, there's power meters that are at $400, which is for cycling equipment too, is pretty inexpensive because everything in cycling, you know, is besides us, is extremely expensive. Like it gets marked up a whole bunch as it goes through the different layers.
You know, I think that's why something like that Watt Team power meter is interesting, how they ship out everything that you need to calibrate the power meter and set it up yourself. Now, granted, the strain gauges still come calibrated, right? But they pass some of that calibration process off to you, and potentially that's where you can get more reductions in price. It'll be interesting to see how they do and what companies do to do that. But I don't think it ever will. There's just that process that's required in it. The hardware in a lot of ways is not that different as the strain gauges.
That's another thing with power meters is people go, oh, they're so expensive. But most power meters, it comes with another piece of cycling equipment. So, you get a full set of cranks, or you get a wheel, or you get a crank
arm. And you get
a
speed sensor, and you get a cadence sensor, and you know what I mean?
It's just built into something else you're going to be buying anyway. So if you take, a cork, and you take a high-end crank set, and then subtract the price, you're like, well, I guess the power meter really isn't that expensive compared, you know, it's not like it's just, you know, $1,500, $1,600, $1,700 all by itself.
Yeah, and then add in the Cadence sensor and all that stuff to that too, because you get that in there too, which is nice. So, all right. Ian, my road racing season starts in early April, and at the time of writing this, I have approximately 20 weeks until that point. You'd like to do a base, build, and specialty plan, so follow all the three different training phases that we have, but time won't permit me to follow the full plan. My thought was to cut the base plan by a couple weeks, complete the full general build, and then complete the full 8-week rolling road race plan. Does this sound reasonable for someone who has time constraints? So Chad, somebody that needs to trim their season or their training plan, where do they do it?
So in your case, Ian, you first have to consider what sort of fitness you're bringing into this. You know, if you're off the couch, base conditioning is going to be a big deal. If you're coming off of a cyclocross season, not as big a deal. You also, and maybe more importantly, need to consider what you're looking at in 20 weeks. Is your peak event in 20 weeks? I mean, do you need to be all the way through your specialty plan and really ready to rip it? Or it sounds like you're just starting your road racing season. So if maybe your fitness isn't topped out, but you've done 12 weeks of base, 12 weeks of build, you're already starting to, you know, feel strong enough to compete in B-level events, and then you kind of train over the next 8 weeks and hone your fitness to the point that when your, you know, more important events roll around sometime within that 8-week span, your fitness is only on the upswing. So if that's the case, I don't think you need to cut anything out. But if you need to trim something, like I said, base it on the sort of fitness you're bringing to the table.
Are there any rules of thumb, Chad, with like trimming, I guess, or if a person is coming in with just a standard amount of base fitness, should they always look to trim towards their base or their specialty? Because it's a common question. We see that from a lot of people.
Yeah, I like people to keep in mind that just because they're in build training, which, you know, we're not talking about cutting build, right? We're talking about cutting either the base or the specialty. So build's going to happen. A build plan, especially the ones we utilize that I've developed, are going to culminate in a pretty high level of fitness. So even if they simply got through the build phase, they're already bringing a fair amount of fitness to those early races.
Yeah. So the idea is like after, you know, if you don't use our build, but in general, you're building your FTP at Punch, you're ready to race. And then you're kind of could be in season. Not many of us have just a single event for the whole year. Mm-hmm. And then during that time for specialty, you could that's where you like ice the cake, right? And you get very specific on your fitness, and you're making gains, and you're probably racing a lot. So
yeah, exactly. When you come out of a build phase, your FTP maybe isn't peaked, but it's pushed way up there, and you could rely on little else. You can still, you know, you can hang with the field. You can maybe even take a flyer and stay away for a while. You get tailed off. You can probably find your way back on. You can probably climb with the guys who are most relevant to you. So you're already pretty usefully fit.
Egan has a question. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I have 16 weeks. So this is another training plan question to prepare for a 6-hour mountain bike race. So a marathon style course. And the caveat here is that with mountain biking, every single course and almost every situation is always full of punchy climbs, even though it's a long day. So your question is, which base build specialty plans would you recommend, and how would you alter the base build specialty plans to accommodate this time frame? So the time frame that you have of 16 weeks. You're coming off an XCO season, so your fitness is pretty good. That's just like what we talked about there, but the season was focused on shorter races. So Chad, somebody that's transitioning from shorter stuff that probably has a pretty good base leading into a season preparing for marathon style stuff and only has 16 weeks to train.
Yeah, in your case, I'd probably just bypass the base period, especially if you feel like you're already bringing reasonable fitness to the table. There is a question of giving yourself a little downtime. Going right from a race season into a build phase might be a little taxing. So maybe you'd consider inserting a couple weeks of just easy mileage or just, you know, recreational, non-structured riding. And then just hop into a build plan. In your case, it's going to be really, you could use any of those considering the events. So if I had to pick one, I'd probably pick short power, but any of those are going to work pretty well. Any of our build plans will work. And then as far as a specialty plan, that's pretty straightforward, the marathon mountain bike plan.
Yeah, and if I could share how I prepared for Marathon Nationals, I think it was a pretty good preparation. I had terrible luck on race day, but a good preparation leading up to it. I made sure to use indoor training, which seems completely counterintuitive, but I made sure to use indoor training extensively for my mountain bike racing. And honestly, it's one of the best environments to do it because of the fact that mountain biking requires quite a lot of structured training based around very hard efforts that last for a short duration and limited rest within that. And that can be pretty tough to replicate when you're dealing with constantly varying trails and everything else. So I used that, but then I made sure that I put in the volume that I could on the weekends with my schedule. That's just how it worked. So I put in the longer volume, whether it was on the trainer or outside on the weekends, while making sure I took more of a short power build approach leading up to the event. And it paid off really well. So, and it's similar demands to what you were actually going up with on the course.
Jonathan, because you mentioned it, do you want to share your horror story about your tires at Nationals?
Yeah, it was at Marathon Nationals in Sun Valley, and I got three flat tires within something like 2 miles. And it turned out that I actually had a defective front wheel. They didn't sand the edge of the front wheel, the seam on the inside, and it was slicing my tires on the bead, and that's why it wouldn't seal. So I had a 12.6-mile hike in rocky shale down a mountainside, and that was like a whole year of preparing. It was terrible.
Yeah, it's after Jonathan dedicated a year to racing like that, and he also was with the front group up the hill, yeah, and then down the hills when he got the flat, which is, if you, people who don't know Jonathan, his downhill is where he has better technical skills than a lot of other mountain bikers, so he could really put some room in there. It was heartbreaking because I wanted him to win so bad. Oh, man.
It sucked.
Was this equipment that you hadn't played with beforehand?
Yes, exactly. And that was the big issue, right? Like, you get a new set of race wheels, you're excited to use them, but
don't ride them.
Yeah, exactly.
They're too much carbon. I'm going to break them.
Yeah, so there's the lesson there.
Oh, and here's the big issue. So I rode with them around on the road, right? Like, it was a mountain bike, but I rode it on very easy trails and everything else because I got them just as I was tapering that week before the race. So number one, not a good idea to get new equipment a week before a race. But then number two, test it like you're going to test it. Mm-hmm. If you get new stuff, don't just roll around the parking lot and call it good. If you get new stuff, put it through what you would actually do on race day. Because for me, that problem didn't show up. That sharp edge didn't cut those tires until I went through a heavy compression while turning. And then that's when it would slice the tires, right? So, yeah. It was a crappy situation.
I totally get that too, because these wheels are so expensive, and unless you're like super rich, like $2,800 for like wheels, like they're breakable, right? You don't want to break those all the time. What I actually do for what I've changed now for triathlons is, obviously, you know, co-founder, trainer, road CEO, I do most of my workouts inside, and then I'll do a few of my longer rides. We have a really good road out whereby I live. And I'll be that dude. I'm like all full kit. I wear my race uniform, my aero helmet, a zip disc, and an 808. And I have my race tires on it and all of that. And I'm just rehearsing just like I would on race day. And also, we get really strong winds out here in Reno. And I'll feel that, right? So I'm really comfortable. Like, it's almost like I'm more comfortable on my deep dish wheels than I am on regular training wheels. And I don't put that many miles on it, but because I'm not doing that much outdoor racing or riding, but when I am outside, I have that. And I'm sure other cyclists look at me and go, yeah. But I blow by a lot of guys too, because I'm all aired out. But whatever. Like, I don't know.
There's the benefit of knowing how to handle your equipment, or how your equipment's going to handle you, how it's going to respond to the conditions, the wind and whatnot. But there's also a tremendous upside to having the confidence, knowing that, yep, it's a really windy day and I've got a disc wheel and a deep section front wheel, but I've done this before. I know I can control my bike in winds like this.
That's huge, right? Because I know I would go out to Washoe Valley, guys, and there'd be this downhill and has really wicked crosswinds. And I got to the point where I go, I feel comfortable in the aero bars going on this downhill, and it saved me a good amount of time. And then on race day, then, most places aren't as windy as Reno when you're actually racing. I thought, no, you know, nothing's going to hurt me because I have the confidence, right? And I've done it before.
Yeah, that's the key. And wrapping it back to just one thing with mountain biking, I really do think more, just because with time now, I'm seeing it already change, this kind of paradigm shift where people are starting to understand that a trainer is not just a plan B for bad weather, but it's a plan A for the best structured workout that you can get. And mountain bikers generally have been the last people to go on an indoor trainer, right? Because they ride their bike to get out and to enjoy, you know, being out in the woods and everything else. But We're going to see more and more mountain bikers. We already are, but we're going to see a lot of mountain bikers using the trainer to prepare for their races in the future. So it's honestly such a fantastic way to do so. As long as you're getting in your skill work and as long as you're staying familiar with that and how your bike handles and everything else, there's no better way to prepare for such intense and varied demands that mountain biking delivers.
Yeah, you said it really well before, is that you can't do structured intervals on the trail. Like, the trail dictates to you. So I have a theory that some like national champions and really good racers just had like really good hills by them that automatically put them to, like, it was like the whatever trail you're riding on is the workout. And they had really good trails that just had the right amount of rest between each climb. And that's where they got really fit on that. And everyone doesn't have that. And, you know, different types of fitness at different types of the year, like a different way you would train, that being able to, like Jonathan said, do the really specific indoor stuff and then get your skills on the outside, you'll just be faster and win. And of course we're saying this, but it's the truth. You should, if you try it and see what happens.
There was a guy from Kansas this year at Mammoth. So Mammoth Mountains, the race elevation was like 8,600 feet. And he was from Kansas. And all he had was short, extremely steep climbs. And he went off the gun so hard at national championships. And he blew up in no time because all he had trained on were the hills around him rather than depicting what he was training on. And the climb was not steep, but it was extended for the first. It was about a 10-15 minute climb. So for 15 minutes, he was completely, he was zapped. You know, he didn't have a 15 minute climb around him, but if he had the trainer, he could have emulated that. So yeah. Charles, next question here. I plan on trying your full base build and specialty for the first time in 2016 as a Cat 2 road racer. However, up here in Canada, the start of my base phase will coincide with the peak of hockey season. Can't mess with hockey season in Canada. Which is about three 30 minute high intensity intervals, really, that you're playing per week. So knowing that, should I use sweet spot base or sweet spot or traditional base and then low, mid, or high volume? So somebody that's cross training with high intensity stuff, Chad, how should that factor into how they pick their base training?
In Charles' case, let's first consider the volume. I think because you're a Cat 2 racer, you're probably going to need something more mid or high volume, but you can get a heck of a lot out of a low volume, three times a week, high intensity training plan too. But it sounds like you're kind of getting that intensity on the rink. So I'm not entirely sure you'd be served with more intensity piled on top of that. So I'm leaning toward traditional base simply because you're already doing quite a lot of high intensity work.
Yeah, I was going to say traditional base mid volume just because he's Cat 2.
Mm-hmm.
Cat 2, you need a lot.
Yeah, that sounds like a safe bet.
Mostly.
And that's assuming you have the time to do that, right? That's really a lot of the time when we talk about low, mid, or high volume and suggestions with that. It's always or one of the greatest considerations to take into account is your available training time, right, Chad?
Exactly right, yeah. So if he's got minimal time outside of that, his three hockey matches a week, then you might have to just make the most out of the sweet spot plan regardless.
James, my question is related to periodization and peaking. How would you approach having the best possible fitness throughout a 16-event Omnium that is spread over a period from February to September with events roughly every 2 weeks? So that's a long race season that you're looking at, and that can be a little tricky. So, Chad, what would you suggest here?
Yeah, that's a really long span, James. Within there, you're probably going to have to pick when you want to be fast and when you can just kind of hang in there and maybe not have high-end fitness, but sufficient fitness. Not necessarily for a duration this long, a span this long, but you're basically looking to get fit and then sustain your fitness. So maybe over a shorter period of a couple months at a time, you can build your fitness, work your way through your specialty plan, racing all the while, swapping out weekend workouts for races, that sort of thing. And then you just have to maintain your high-end fitness and even your low-end fitness, which it sounds like you've actually got a really good structure to your couple of weeks, and that one weekend includes a long weekend ride, the next weekend includes a race weekend. So really, you just have to address what takes place during the week, in which case a couple days of short but intense workouts, a large part of that time span will probably suffice.
You know, and this actually isn't too uncommon, especially these days. Like, the internet and cyclocross are like peanut butter and jelly, it seems. They just go together really well. And everyone is riding cross now, more and more people. So a lot of people are doing year-round seasons. And whether you notice it or not, you're kind of going through the same thing where you're having to maintain fitness for specific races, but those races come up at somewhat consistent intervals throughout the whole year, throughout 12 months. So this is advice for a lot of folks that may not even realize it.
And the tri season is usually like this. It can be really long, especially with like Oceanside, that's really early in the year, and then like Kona at the very, very end of the year, Ironman Arizona in November. And what I would do with this is I would kind of like start racing mid build and kind of go through that. So I kind of have some more build going and then specialty. And then I might, depending on how I feel, especially if I'm racing on the weekend, I might repeat specialty to just get those weekday workouts, because those are more of the intervals that are specific to my type of racing. That'll kind of keep me consistent, and I can make little tweaks to kind of ice the cake and get as fast as I can while I'm in
season. Yeah, that's actually something I forgot to mention as far as where you pluck those workouts from. The specialty phase is ideal. So the weekday workouts, maybe in the latter weeks, those are obviously going to be the harder, more demanding workouts. And you could even, if you realize, you know, you're kind of stretched a little too thinly, shift over to the taper workouts. They've got all the intensity. They're much shorter, much more forgiving, but they'll help you kind of keep that edge for a little while longer without overly taxing you and leaving you wasted come race weekend.
James, or forgive me, Rozzy. And once again, I hope I'm pronouncing that one all right. Well, when it comes to winter training, having a goal of being a faster and stronger endurance cyclist, which platform is more efficient, indoor training or the velodrome? That's a good one. What do you think, Chad?
I think when it comes to your more general training, I would lean toward the trainer simply because it's more controllable. I suppose as far as a controllable environment that isn't a trainer, the track is probably the next best thing. But I think in terms of cultivating very specific types of fitness, again, being on a trainer eliminates a lot of the variables, a lot of the concerns that you have when you have to hold a bike upright, maybe other riders on the track, things like that. At some point, though, you've obviously got to get very specific, and that's when you start to shift some of your training, or at least incorporate some more time on the track into, you know, whatever it is you're doing. So closer you get to your events, you're going to spend more time on the track. But up until then, I would lean toward the indoor trainer.
Yeah, the velodrome is nice because there's no stoplights, but still it's going to be how you ride. So do you have a very detailed power-based plan that you're doing, and you're going to hit your intervals, each one at the correct power, and you're going to do this while maintaining the mental energy to ride on the track? If you can do that, I mean, you could potentially make it just as effective as indoor training. But the mental energy and all that, I just think it would be much more, and two, you don't have to drive to the velodrome, right? So like you just do it at your house in the morning or pay for any of the money. So I agree with Chad. Indoor training first and then get more specific, because there are specific skills that you need on the velodrome.
Yeah, that's completely – I agree with that. I was actually just at a coaching clinic just a couple of weeks ago, and we had a number of different athletes there that actually train on and ride on the velodrome regularly with great success. A couple of them actually national champions and everything else. And – it was kind of funny to see, because Keith Ketterer, for any of you who know him, he's a fantastic guy. He's a legend in the mountain biking world and the track world. He had been riding so much on the velodrome that we were just going through slow, low speed turn drills. And he was commenting on how he felt like a fish out of water because of the fact that he was so used to carrying momentum and just going left. It's specificity is everything when you're training, right? And the velodrome also teaches you certain things that you just will not get elsewhere, right? And like, for example, it teaches you to maintain momentum, stay in your aero position all the way through turns, to be disciplined with that aero position, to be constant. If you're riding a fixed gear, it's going to train a pedal stroke that at least you're going to be dealing with force all around the pedal stroke. So that'll train certain aspects of what you're doing. So there are definite benefits to the velodrome, but if we're talking structured training, and your exact question that you had, Rozzy, was being a faster and stronger endurance cyclist, the velodrome, I don't think it would hurt you, but I don't think it's the best, most specific tool. So you can be specific. You have a Swiss Army knife at your disposal these days. So Dieter, in April 2016, I will go to the Belgium's Classic Tour of Flanders. Awesome. That's a cool race. The tour consists of 60% flat roads, 10% of bad cobblestones, and 30% of short climbs between 5 and 22%. What kind of wheel set should I use for this ride? That's the question. I have carbon wheels and aluminum wheels. So before we get into anything else, we'll talk about that part first. And I'm curious to get your guys' perspectives on this, but I mean, traditionally, everyone talked about box rims, the old aluminum style box wheels that they used to use on the cobbles. And really, the reason that they did that was because the wheels were pretty weak. In other words, that they were compliant, or better said, right? So they were compliant, and they took away some of the sting of the cobbles. And they were also more durable in this case than what they have with the steel ones. But there's, I think that especially in cycling, and I want to be careful here, but especially in cycling, there's a lot of old or tired paradigms here. Carbon fiber wheels are fantastic for a number of reasons, but one of them is because they build into the wheels intentionally. They build them to be compliant for situations like this. And I don't know if you guys have noticed who have ridden carbon wheels, but you get a very smooth ride. So as long as you have wheels that you don't mind if you get a flat and you hit a few cobbles as the air is coming out of the tire, or you don't mind running them through and getting them retrued if you need to do that, then I would absolutely suggest going for carbon wheels. You also say that you're not excessive weight or height or anything else like that, so it would make sense. Nate, what do you think?
Yeah, so I'm going to share with you how stupid I am. By the way, this is Chad, not Nate. I'm just kidding. This is Nate. Okay, so I have a full-size Toyota Tundra, so it's a big pickup truck, like a F-150. And I backed over my Zip 808 with the truck, ran right over it. All that happened to the wheel was the hub had to be replaced. The carbon survived. Like, we tested it over and over. It's been written up 1,000 times for that. It's, you know, you can do these tap tests and see if there's any cracks. It was perfectly fine. And I ran over it with the truck, a big truck. You're at 74 kilograms. I think you'll be fine with carbon wheels, as long as they're, you know, not some, what, like, there was, back in the olden days, there were some really bad carbon wheels, but is anything modern, you're probably okay.
Yeah, and I would suggest,
I would use carbon wheels.
Yeah, and if at the very least for comfort, number two, they're able to shape the rim more to get a little bit more aerodynamic advantage out of this, more efficiency. For a ride like that with Flanders, I wouldn't be looking at anything deep, too deep. If you can run anything like a Zip 303 would probably be ideal for that. Maybe a 404 gets you some aero advantage. And I know the 303s, which, correct me, and this is just across, this is just with Zip wheels, and this is what I know, so that's why I'm sharing this. But I've heard that those are a good compromise in between weight, strength, and aerodynamic advantage. They're kind of like the best happy medium with the 303s. But I really think in any direction, 202s, 303s, 404s, that's probably going to be around your sweet spot. So I don't know what type of wheels you have, but hopefully that gives you some info. And then tying into that, you also ask, what kind of pressure should I use? And this is an interesting one, because in most cases, we're seeing that actually running a lower pressure, in some cases, that's becoming kind of en vogue, to run a lower pressure with your wheels. And this is usually accomplished in conjunction with running tubeless tires. Because of that, you're able to get a really, you don't have that friction layer between the tube and the tire, and you're able to get a very supple feel. But this may not be a good idea to run really low pressure. You're going to have to find a sweet spot. So because once again, you're running the damage. If you're running tubeless, you won't have pinch flats, but you're going to possibly harm the tire or pop the bead off the rim or anything else like that. If you're running into a harsh cobble, if you're running tubes, you could get a pinch flat. So you're going to have to find a compromise.
So, this is really, I find this really interesting. I used to always ride at the max PSI for whatever tires I had. So that's usually about like 120. And I thought that the harder they are, I'll have less rolling resistance. So I'll have less, you know, drag that I'm overcoming as my wheel is going on the ground. And then I saw an interesting thing. I think Jordan Rapp posted it on Slow Twitch. But they took Zip Engineers and Continental work together. And there is this kind of U-shape for where drag is, where if you're at, let's say, 120, actually 110 has less drag. And they went down to, I think the front wheel was like 95 was the sweet spot, and the rear wheel was 90 for PSI. And those were on Zip 808 and a Zip disc in the back with a Continental what are they, Grand Prix 4000 S2? Those were the tires, and there's some other stuff recent saying that those were really good with rolling resistance, and Zip said they paired really well with those tires. But having that less rolling resistance was actually faster. And then if you went lower than that, like down to 80, then it got the drag like started, or the rolling resistance started to raise again. So the sweet spot was right in there, and it's going to have to do with your weight a lot too. But I've been pumping my tires up for racing to just to 95 in the front and 90 in the back. And then the other thing is having an accurate pump, is everyone thinks, oh, you know, your pump could be off by 10 pounds. You don't, it's, I know there's like, there's some boutique pumps out there for $400, but try to get a secondary pump or some way to, maybe two or three if you have friends, to try to figure out what the actual pressure is. Because you can't just say, I've had this pump for 20 years, and you pump it up to 100. Maybe it's really 120, or maybe it's 80.
Yeah, even a cheap little pressure gauge will cover that base.
Yes, that's the best thing to do, is to get a pressure gauge that works well, that you know works well, and then to just get a pump that's easy to pump, mm-hmm. right?
yeah, that's a good idea.
Because they always vary from one to the next. And keep in mind, since you're riding on cobbles, your tire is going to be traveling. It's not like riding on a flat surface. You're going to be dipping down in the texture of the cobbles, and then in between them as well. So actually running a lower pressure that's going to cause less deflection when you're going over those cracks is also beneficial. And that's especially noted in the mountain bike world. They're running lower and lower pressure because they find that the deflection caused when you're going over those rocks actually causes more rolling resistance in the end. So yeah, find the sweet spot. You're on the lighter side of average for sure. So I mean, I would expect it to be below 100 PSI, but look up the tires and wheels you have and see if there's any information on ideal tire pressures that you can use. And the final question that you ask, any other advice on how to ride on cobblestones? I would say, so first of all, I always find it funny because the majority, Dieter, you're in a very small amount of people that ride cobblestones, right? Like we see cobbles on TV, but when was the last time we all rode cobbles? I know I haven't ridden them for over a year, and they weren't even cobbles. It was like brick. Yeah. So
pavers.
But the same principle applies in mountain biking, and it's, I call it hovering. And essentially what you'll want to do is when you go to those sections, you'll want to position your body so that, number one, there isn't a lot of tension in your upper body. You're going to want to let your bike move somewhat freely underneath you in that respect. And then you'll also want to carry a little more tension through your legs, though. And really the result that you should get is hovering your butt just off the seat, maybe a millimeter or two. In fact, you'll still feel like you're connected to it. There's just less pressure from your butt into the saddle. And if you do that when you're pedaling through and you're going through these bumps, it's massively helpful in keeping the power down and not causing you to get disturbed over that. And your kidneys will thank you by the end of the day as well, which is nice. So anything else to add to that, Chad?
Just even pressure on the pedals. So if you can keep pedaling, all the better.
Ziv, I did an Ironman last year, and you were only able to average 50% FTP for 7 hours. That was your average. So what training plan would you recommend to be able to hold 70% FTP that long in the future? It's kind of a vague question, Chad, but what could you provide him on any type of advice?
Well,
there?
First off, he actually follows this with, my goal is not to increase my FTP, but to increase the percentage of FTP that I can hold for a long time. Let's get one thing straight. Increases in FTP are never a bad thing. So your goal should still be to elevate your FTP, because working at 50% of 250 watts versus improving that to 280 watts and working at 50% of that, same toll on your body, more speed. So FTP increases are still desirable for sure. Beyond that, actually first let's start with the fact that you're a long or a full distance triathlete. So obviously a big aerobic base is a concern. So which base tack you decide to take is going to depend largely on how many hours a week you can devote to training. If you're, you know, maybe eight or more hours, I'd lean towards more of a long, slow, traditional approach. Less than that, and you're going to have to make the most of the least, which, you know, shuttles you toward the sweet spot base side of things. But your big concern is increasing your muscular endurance. So maybe you can really wail on the pedals for a minute at a time. That doesn't really help much when it comes to turning them for 112 miles. So you need to increase your ability to push the pedals harder for substantially longer. You have to increase your endurance, your strength endurance in particular. And that's accomplished with a lot of sweet spot and threshold and VO2 max work. But the trajectory, once you've moved past your base training, is probably a sustained power build and then into a full distance triathlon plan.
Yeah. And another thing that a lot of people don't get is that, like, the percentage of FTP you ride for an Ironman. Well, so Ziv is going for 7 hours, which is, that's a long time, and it's on the longer end of bike splits. So your percentage of FTP is going to naturally be lower than if you're a professional and you ride for 4 hours, right? That makes sense. Professional might go all the way up to like 80% or even a little bit above that. So if you raise your FTP, you'll be able to ride even higher percent of FTP because you'll, your ride will now be just 7 or 6 hours instead of 7. You can take a whole hour off your Ironman time. So as Chad said, raise that FTP. It'll be awesome. And that'll make it a lot easier to, you'll have a lot faster race and everything will be easier.
Yep. Yeah. It'll just make you faster, and faster rider means less time that you have to be out on course. So.
And less time on the bike means probably a more tolerable run.
Yeah, as long as you didn't blow yourself up, right? And then second question that you have, a follow-up. You say that you're in your base training phase for an Ironman race this summer. You're currently in that. With the Christmas break coming up, I have a week off, and I want to cram as much bike training as possible into it. What would be your recommendation? So he wants to cram some training in there, Chad.
Yeah, again, because you're coming from a Ironman background, and that's your goal event, aerobic endurance is what you're looking for. You're trying to condition your body or your muscles, more specifically, to metabolize fat, to use that energy source that you're basically never going to run out of. So if you're going to do a cram session, for a couple of reasons, I'd advise you to not do it with intensity. You can only take so much intensity before you start to break down, perhaps get injured, but certainly you're going to start back and you're going to be crushed. You're going to be tired, and that however long it takes you to recover could derail some progress. So I would focus on traditional base over sweet spot base. And it doesn't even have to be that specific so much as do some long, slow rides and see how much time on the bike you can accumulate before you start to derail or go backwards, get too tired.
So Ziv, here's what you need to do. You need to get the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy extended, the Hobbit trilogy, Harry Potter, and watch all of those in a week while you're riding the entire time.
And maybe
the
Die Hard,
Game of Thrones, and Die Hard trilogy, since it's Christmas and Die Hard is a Christmas movie. That would be nice too.
As much low intensity as you can take.
Yeah, it's just going to be, you know, it's as Chad said, yeah, lots of endurance.
Yep. Okay, Christopher, what is the best approach to resuming a structured training plan if I've spent a week away from the bike doing fairly strenuous activities? So the opposite situation that we just had.
So he gave us a description of what his strenuous days are, and they sound pretty strenuous. So you probably need to recover a bit before you start hitting the hard stuff. That could mean maybe a day of complete rest and then a day of a scaled down workout before you dive back into the intensity. It all depends on, you know, just how tired you are coming out of these strenuous activities you're talking about. Typically, whenever there's a training interruption, one that, you know, takes place over the span of a couple of days, some people can get away with diving right back into full high intensity workouts. But a lot of the time it's a matter as simple as cutting that next high intensity workout in half, just doing half the workout. Don't trim the intensity at all. Just do, you know, if it's a 4-set workout, do 2 sets. And then the next day you'll probably be right back on track.
I have another embarrassing confession to make. So I was dating my wife, this girlfriend at the time, and I was about a week away from my first Ironman, and her dad, she had just bought a house, and her dad and her brother were going to lay patio pavers on this giant patio. It was going to take 2 days, and they're like, oh, come, and I wanted to impress her dad so much, but I was like, sorry, I'm tapering for an Ironman. No way am I going to put that much, like, you know, it's going to be like 2 8-hour days of moving pavers all around. And it was going to destroy me. And luckily, I think her dad likes me still, but we need out of that. And that's just an anecdote of kind of when you get close to something, the other kind of stress will affect your training and racing.
Absolutely.
That's dedication. And she's still married you. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's dedication there. okay. The next, and Christopher, you answered or you asked some other questions that kind of tied in line with this about stacking shorter training sessions back to back before or after a period away from the bike. I assume what you're trying to do is kind of make up work or do make up work in advance, so to speak. Chad, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you can get away with that to some extent. But as with anything, it depends on how well you respond to it. A lot of times over the course of a training plan, I've seen athletes get a really good training response by rather than doing maybe Tuesday intervals, Wednesday off, Thursday intervals, they do a day of intervals on Tuesday and then one on Wednesday, and then they rest for a couple of days. So it's a bigger dose of stress, but then they follow it with a bigger dose of recovery. And if you know you've got recovery following it, it's not such a bad idea. It doesn't sound like that's the case with you. It sounds like you're going to beat yourself up on the bike, and then you're going to go and beat yourself up off the bike. And that's just going to lead one direction. That's down.
Yeah, that's a pretty common question in general that we get is that, you know, you'll do, life happens and work happens. So I either have 4 or 3 days a week training. So although not ideal, but it sounds like, Chad, some people it would actually be better for them. Mm-hmm. But it's okay to put it in there and test it out. Just because we say it's Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday for some of your low volume training doesn't mean those have to be on that day. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I've known some pretty high level racers. In fact, some very high level racers who one of them springs to mind. He's a firefighter. So he has to get all of his training in a very consolidated length of time. And then he knows he might not be doing anything. You know, if they're fighting a fire, obviously they're going to be doing quite a lot of labor. But if they're not and they're just hanging around the firehouse and cleaning fire engines, then there's their recovery. So for him, it worked exceptionally well. Big dose of stress, big dose of recovery, and an all-around fast rider.
Joe, I'm a 56-year-old mountain biker, and in the fall of 2014, I tried a ketogenic or low-carb diet. I found that I recovered very quickly from workouts and can go all day as long as I stayed aerobic. But I just didn't have that pop on the hills or the energy to really push it when I needed it. I have also tried a more paleo diet in the past. What would be your suggestion? So first off, we always shudder whenever we get nutrition questions because it's such an individual thing.
Get your knives out. Everyone has an opinion too, yeah. With not a lot of science to back it up.
It's a big topic.
Yeah, but are there any type of insights that we can give without fear here?
just that if you're going to work hard, fat metabolism is probably not going to cover it. No matter how fat adapted you become, no matter... how lean you get, if you haven't got sugar to burn, then the high intensity stuff is simply not going to happen.
Yeah, your muscles use glycogen to as you get above FTP or you get out of aerobic, you're going to tap from your glycogen stores in your muscles to push you forward, and those are mainly replaced by carbohydrates. They can be replaced by protein. And correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, but it takes your liver and it takes a little bit longer to do that. Carbohydrates are going to be the way to do that. People can actually see, like bodybuilders do this, they will carb load before they have a very specific way to eat before a competition because it will make their muscles more full. And you'll actually get more carbohydrates in your legs and it's visible, more glycogen. Another thing is that sometimes people will do, this is kind of a tangent, but they'll do a longer ride and be like, oh, I lost 10 pounds. And they think, oh, that means I lost 10 pounds of water, when they're not taking into account the glycogen that they lost of all the training that they did. So just because you lost 10 pounds doesn't mean you lost 10 pounds of water. There's the thing that people forget about is glycogen in your muscles.
Yeah, and Joe, if you actually become a fat-adapted athlete, then you may actually be able to work at a really high percentage of FTP almost entirely aerobically, right? So whereas most of us are stuck at 75, maybe 80% before we start metabolizing more and more sugar, maybe you're 85, 90%, and that's great for sub-threshold efforts. But when it comes to working above threshold and repeating efforts above threshold, the sugar has to be there. So a lot of keto-adapted athletes will actually cycle carbohydrates into their diet based on the performance demands of whatever, whatever's coming up that weekend or whatever events they're finally arriving at or just for their high-intensity workouts.
Now, for that, Chad, I have a question for you. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Are there studies that have shown that someone can change the percentage at like a certain intensity, change the percentage of fat to carbohydrates? Or is it something that you're kind of born with? Like mm-hmm. I'm more of a carbohydrate rider or more of a fat rider?
No, everything.
And it kind of stays the same.
Everything I've read on the Banting method and ketogenic diets has shown a distinct shift in the level of fat metabolism. So more work while metabolizing fat. So like I said, before... they, if you did a gas exchange, you actually saw where that carbohydrate and fat relation was, that would actually improve as they became more fat adapted, improve in the sense that they're burning more fat and sparing the carbohydrate for longer and longer.
That's very interesting.
It is.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing. It's definitely not static. It can be trained. And then also the people, keep in mind that people also do enter into the starting these ketogenic diets or whatever it is, probably at different levels. So, of adaptation.
Yeah, there's always a question of how damaged your metabolism is, how sugar or insulin insensitive you are, carbohydrate intolerant, all these buzzy terms. But the worse off you are, the longer it takes to transition. And over the course of that transition, it can be some really miserable training.
Lee, 9 weeks ago, I had a non-cycling related accident that caused damage to my cervical spine and nervous system. Your central cord syndrome, you say. My doctor and physio have cleared me to resume gentle turbo trainer sessions as part of my rehab. I've identified Volunteer, and that's, by the way, that's the name of one of our workouts that's generally a recovery workout. It's a short 30-minute workout that keeps the intensity pretty low as an ideal jumping-off point. So that's what he's identified there. But was wondering if I should retest to baseline my FTP or simply play it by ear with my current settings and manually adjust the effort based on my prevailing strength, which I assume is pretty low right now. Chad, what are your thoughts there?
Definitely a question better for your doctor than for us, but I would guess intensity is probably something to be avoided for a while. And an FTP test is by its nature intense. I think you can get away with riding simply by perceived exertion, just getting used to being on the bike again, seeing what you can get away with, and heart rate based training even.
Yeah. Just so we don't get sued, your doctor says gentle turbo trainer sessions are okay. FTP test is not gentle. Don't do it. Don't do it. Go gentle. Exactly. Listen to your doctor. This sounds like you're not an American based on how you say turbo instead of trainer, or as you say turbo instead of indoor trainer. So you probably won't sue, but Americans, you're listening, listen to your doctor.
And then the final part of his question, once I regain some power and strength, which base training plan would you suggest? Once again, this kind of depends on the feedback that you get from your doctor, I would think. And then once again, that available time that you have for training, right, Chad?
Yeah, and of course your goals. So I want to say just stick with traditional base for a good long while until it's clear that this isn't going to exacerbate any issues with your nervous system. And then, of course, defer to your doctor.
John, the question essentially that John has, he gives us quite a lot of information, and he's an athlete that's doing a 70.3, and then he has quite a few months. He has a long time until he's going in, or what, about 6 months or so, 7 months maybe, until he's going into a full Ironman instead of a half Ironman. So his question, how do you train for a full after completing a 70.3? What do you say to that, Chad? Coming off of a 70.3, how do you transition to full distance training?
So first off, I don't know exactly how much time you have, but it sounds like you've got at least 4 months. So safely 16 weeks, and it's probably a couple extra on top of that. Firstly, make sure you're recovered. Don't try to dive right back into training coming off of that half Ironman, especially if you really, really went for it. And then you're looking to basically rebuild your FTP again. You probably don't need to start from scratch in terms of base conditioning. So maybe just a half of a build plan. So the sustained power, pick the latter 4 weeks or the earlier 4 weeks, whichever suits your level of motivation, and maybe if you're targeting TSS, whichever is a better fit. And then you want to obviously maintain your aerobic endurance, you know, your fat burning capabilities, and that can be done with as little as a single long ride every couple of weeks. But you know, if you can work one in every weekend, and most of the plans factor that in, then you're covered there. And then just time to re-specialize and pick the full distance triathlon plan.
And Tommy, Chris, you have a question. How do you adapt if you miss some weekends? And you mentioned that longer rides are harder to fit in. You can see that just ignoring occasional missed workouts, but how about a cold where you start or where you lose a week and then restart? So this relates to something that we were talking about earlier, Chad, about missing a week, but does it change at all when you're sick, or what special conditions come into play there?
It's kind of along the same lines. So when you decide to dive back in, just don't go, you know, don't try to make up for lost time. Don't try to overdo it right out of the gates. So perhaps you do an easy workout, and then when you're ready to start the hard stuff again, maybe even the very next day, just trim the workout in half. just leave something in the tank when you're done. You know, your immune system is already challenged. Your body's on the rebound. Don't make it any more taxing than absolutely necessary. And for something as short as a week, you can probably dive right back in where you would be if you hadn't missed any time off.
This is where my wife actually makes mistakes. She doesn't listen, so I can say that.
She never makes mistakes, Nate. She never does.
Yeah. Is that she'll get sick, and she'll train right through the sickness, and then when she's better, she just does, you know, she runs a half marathon every weekend and does like 2 train and road sessions. She won't change a thing, and it will take her so much longer to get back, and she's hating life. And if she would just rest for a couple days and then get back into it, she'd be stronger and more fit. And it's so hard for type A personalities, like, you know, even especially if you're injured or something, but to take a little bit of time off to get the rest, just know that you can do it. It's you're going to become faster if you recover from being sick.
And the one thing that I think a lot of us forget, our immune system is taxed and responsible for a large portion of our recovery. Or I should say it's involved in helping us recover from our heavy workouts and our training. And when you're sick and your immune system's helping you recover from that, plus helping you recover from hard workouts, it's easy to see where you can really get run down quickly. So think of your immune system. Take that little guy into consideration.
Yeah. Another, a point about that. I'm doing all this sharing today. I feel so vulnerable, but I've mentioned before on this that I can't take a lot of training stress, and I actually have a suppressed, immune system. My IgG3, which is a blood marker, is actually pretty low. And I'm trying to work on getting that fixed. But just to go to Jonathan's point is that actually, your immune system does play a big point in recovery.
Absolutely. Tommy, the final question for today. So Tommy, you ask, how do you train best for racing on a recumbent or in a velomobile? I don't know what a velomobile is. Do you guys know what a velomobile? I mean, I assume it's a recumbent, but I don't know what it is.
It says there are 3 wheels on a velomobile, so it requires no balance.
Oh, gotcha. And I'm looking at it now. It's like encased. So this is one of those ones that you can go super fast where they break like records. You know, it's all aerodynamic out.
Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. You poke a much smaller hole, much more aerodynamic through the air. So you're asking, how do you best train for this? And then later on, another portion of your question is, can I benefit from incorporating training on the ordinary bike, both indoors and outdoors? And if so, how should I train to use the ordinary bike in my training? So, Chad, do you have any experience in this?
I have none, but it goes back to basically how we answered the question with the track cyclist. I mean, you can get your conditioning in a more general manner, and then as you get towards your event, you have to make it more specific. So I think you can get everything you need out of a regular bike on a regular trainer. And then should you have the option of hooking up your velomobile to a trainer, then absolutely, maybe start splitting time earlier than later. But I don't see any reason why you wouldn't be fine on a regular bike.
Yeah, you'll be getting benefit, but he will be in a different position, right?
Yeah, so like I said, as he gets closer to his event, you know, maybe does 3 out of 4 base workouts on the regular bike, and then does 2 out of 3 on the build workouts on the velomobile, and then does every other specialized workout on it. But either way,
if I had a choice, if I could put the recumbent bike on a trainer, I would go 100% recumbent on the trainer, just because it is specific. And I'm so, maybe you get this from listening to the podcast, but I am so anal that when I was first getting into this and I wanted to be a triathlete, I was like, I don't want to buy a road bike because that will take time away from my specific time trialing. I want only a TT bike and that's it.
No, I agree. I was reading this question as he was trying to look for whether or not it would be just as efficacious to train on his regular bike. But if you have the setup, I mean, it's the same thing with time trials. If you want to be a good time trialist, spend a lot of time on your TT bike, maybe all of it. So if you have the option, the equipment, then yeah, absolutely. Why not spend all your time on that thing?
I know I'm spending, every workout so far this year, or prepping for this next year, has all been done on my mountain bike. Whereas last year I did the majority of them on my road bike on the trainer. And I felt a big difference last year in how I could put out power on the mountain bike compared to the road bike. So something I noticed now this year, I'm adjusting for that. So I'm becoming like you, Nate. Yes. Maybe becoming anal. I don't know.
It's all the time you spend around me. And so Jonathan does that too. Is he put his he puts his mountain bike on a Wahoo kicker, right? Because you take the rear wheel off, and
it's super easy. They have a little through axle adapter, and then if you don't have that and you have a just a normal trainer, I know Kinetic makes a through axle adapter that works with most bikes that have 12 mil through axles, and you can run that on the back, and it makes it pretty easy. You just have to change your tire then. So.
Yeah, would you rather get another wheel that kind of has the tire mounted all the time, like a really cheap one?
Especially because most of us are running tubeless these days, right? So you're going to deal with sealant going all over the place and then buying sealant and putting it back in. It becomes a mess. So, in fact, my brother's going to be preparing for a four-day bike packing trip, and we'll be climbing, like 50,000 feet in 4 days. And we're going from Markleeville, California to Downeyville, which is going to be awesome. And he's actually going to be training on a Kinetic on a 7-inch suspension, I think, full suspension mountain bike that's like almost a downhill bike. He's going to hook the thing up to the trainer, and he's going to be training on that to make it with us. So pretty cool stuff. So make it as specific as you can get. That's the takeaway on that one. So. All right. Thanks for joining us, guys. Thanks for the questions. We had a big variety this week. That was good. So keep your questions coming. Just submit them to support@trainerroad.com, and we will put them into the queue for the next week, and we'll answer as many as we can. Thanks for joining us, guys. Happy training.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.